بسم الله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه ثم أما بعد. Proceed. So someone asked, why did this happen now? Brother Masoud, I think, is here. Well, the idea here is the closer you know, the longer the night stays, the closer the Fajr, is. So, closer to the end of the night, when people really have a very long night, that is when the Fajr comes. That's one thing. Second is the immediate causes behind this. The forgery that took place in the last elections, elections for the parliament. The other thing is economic situations that are difficult. Two, three, concerns about Mubarak running for office again. Concerns about him running for office, and if he doesn't run, concerns that his son may run. That would be three. Four, police brutality. Police brutality. Five, I think the part of it is related to Gaza, because a lot of people felt sort of impotent, like, you know, you have a government that keeps you from even giving. Like this impotence that the people felt was sort of hard on your, like, pride. And it just makes you feel incapacitated. I think all of those combined, amongst other reasons, came to a point of boiling. But what helped the boiling manifest as protests, even though Egypt was boiling for many years, is the power of the internet to a certain extent. Why the internet? Not because, you know, the internet builds the momentum, creates the anger, but at least it builds the awareness to a great extent. Because people became more aware of police brutality and torture in police stations and so on through the internet. So it builds the awareness. But it has the ability to circumvent the ban on assembling. Egypt has been for 30 years, Mubarak has never ruled without state of emergency laws. So, emergency laws ban assembling. So you can't have large groups of people assemble for any function. In this way, how do you create momentum to protest, to go out in large demonstrations like this? People do not have no ability to communicate. They have no ability to communicate. The internet serves that purpose. Give the people the ability to communicate effectively, and communications can reach hundreds of thousands of people quite fast. So all of this contributed. That's why the government shut the internet down. It's amazing. So some other reflections on this. One is that theological versus civilian rulership. In Islam, there is no theological rulership in the sense that is thought of in the West. But our emphasis that this is civilian, this is a state that is civilian, not religious. It's not a religious state, it's not Dawla Dinia, it's a civilian state, is is a little painful because it's a little painful because you're not really clarifying that the Sharia is supreme. You're just saying this, even if you are an Islamist, you're saying this, and in the back of your mind, you say to yourself, yes, the Islamic State is a civilian rulership. I can say that and then comfort them, but Islamic State is a civilian rulership to a great extent. But again, the masses do not, when the masses hear this, it seems like we're clearing ourselves of Allah, of His being, which is somewhat painful. I understand the motives of the people. Yeah, but understanding the motives of the people also makes you truly understand that the Muslim countries are not independent countries. I don't think there is one Muslim country that's an independent country. Even the most successful, like Malaysia and Turkey and so on and so forth, they're not independent countries. It sounded when people are talking, particularly on satellite TVs, that everybody is talking to America. Everybody is talking to the West. You know, whether they are from the opposition or from the government, everybody is making the message in order to convince or persuade the West to support them, or to at least leave us alone. But people were always cognizant of the influence of the West, which is true. I'm not saying that they were wrong, but it shows you that we're not independent countries. Well, you know, when it's a little bit pathetic for here in the Congress to be talking about, like a senator, a woman from in the Senate talking about not allowing the Muslim Brotherhood to rule Egypt. I mean, what do you think? This is another country, lady. Why don't you just mind your own business? But that is the reality. Yes, our countries are ruled from here or from Europe, so we're not completely independent. That tells you that a big part of this rests on our shoulders, because we're backward and we're economically retarded, behind and retarded, and economic and military power will translate into political power and political independence. But without the economic and military power, you're not going to be independent. So there's a lot of work to be done to be truly independent. Hopefully, a new beginning in Egypt will start to move the people in the right direction. But there is a lot of work to be done to become independent. That is one thing. The other thing that is also interesting is, my thoughts now will not be organized. I'm just going to bring them out as they come. The other thing that was interesting is the neighborhood defense committees. Because when on that Friday, when the government felt that things are getting out of control, they let about 20,000 people out of the prison system, and they sort of let them loose. And they used their own government thugs, because our government were used to be, they have their own thugs. Particularly the ruling party, they have like lists of thousands of thugs that they would use for various purposes. So they used them to create havoc and fear so that the people would run for the government to help them reestablish peace and security. The people did not. But so the people formed their own neighborhood defense committees. That is drawing again from the Tunisian experience, or benefiting from the Tunisian experience. It may have evolved in Egypt to allow the Tunisian experience, but the fact that they were able to think of it and assemble it this quickly has to do with, you know, the benefiting from the Tunisian experience. Those neighborhood defense committees, and I used to oversee many of those committees. I would go around to, you know, sort of Dawah, it's a good Dawah time. So I used to spend from sundown to sunup, going around the various committees, talking to them and stuff, and people who were going to the demonstrations next day, talk to them about issues and things of that nature. So the first day we arrested four thieves. And some of them were armed. But what I witnessed, and part of the reason why I was keen to participate in overseeing some of those committees, is that the tyranny of the police is but a manifestation of the tyranny of the people. Because the people in the neighborhood defense committees are well-meaning, good people. You do notice the tyranny in some of them, which manifests when, you know, someone comes in to the checkpoint, for instance. They start, you know, some people may have wished to be police officers or something of that nature. They start talking with so much confidence and authority. And after all, he's like a second year in college. You know, get real. You're not a real authority here. You're just standing here holding a stick with everybody else. To protect the neighborhood, but then don't go into, you know, details of things, or what's your job and what are you doing, or who are you? So I used to get in a lot of fights, and they were very respectful, but I used to get into a lot of fights with them because of this attitude. Like a lot of people have attitude like the police officer. So the idea that you replace a regime does not mean that that's it, that's the cure. You really need to work on the people, on the attitude of the people, the behavior of the people, the collective awareness, collective culture of the people in our Muslim countries. And that work is enormous. So we should not... Certainly you should be happy that you finished the stage or a phase, but that phase may be the easiest of the ones to come, because to really fix a nation is much more difficult than toppling a regime. So that was another observation. The other observation too is patriotic feelings. Patriotism, we said before, could be another manifestation of selfishness. Selfishness. Okay. Could be another manifestation of the core egotism that would manifest into selfishness. Tribalism, pianism, racism, you know, classism, patriotism. To love your own country is acceptable, is expected. To love your homeland in some sense is expected. وَحَبَّ بَعْطَانَ الرِّجَالِ إِلَيْهِمُ مَعَارِبُ قَضَاهَ الشَّبَابُ هُنَالِكَ إِذَا ذَكَرُوا أَوْطَانَهُمْ ذكرتهم عمود الصبا فحنوا لذلك. So what the people were made to love their countries because of memories they have in their youth. If they remember their countries, they remember those fond memories, and then they feel nostalgia for their countries. So that it is expected. However, and it is also an Islamic concept that you give it to your neighbor. And then the other neighbor, and then the farther neighbor, and the farther neighbor. So in a sense, you be good to your compatriots, in a sense. Because if you take the circle out farther away. But after all, ultimate allegiance is for Allah and His Messenger. إِنَّمَا عَلَيْكُمْ اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا Your ally is Allah and His Messenger and the believers. And patriotism, in what happened during the revolution also is the rise of patriotism, because a government that is in trouble, and politicians are like this, they really appeal to the lowest instincts of humanity, the lowest denominators, the lowest instincts of humanity. It's an emotional appeal to, you know, to resist change. As if, now these are plots that's coming from outside, from abroad. So regardless, whether you're Arab, non-Arab, Muslim, non-Muslim, this or that, if you're not Egyptian, then you must be plotting against the country. And the government tries to make this feeling permeate through the ranks of the people, so that they resist journalists, for instance, or they bar movement of people, particularly media people, and so on and so forth. And sometimes the opposition also, because the opposition always, they always have to respond. And when you have an opposition that is not really guided opposition, we will talk about guided opposition here. The opposition is made up of communists and liberalists and Islamists and nothingness, like they're upset, but they don't have ideology per se. And in this atmosphere, you will have all sorts of responses. So sometimes the opposition would emphasize that patriotism, which is quite unhealthy. This nation of yours is one nation, and your lords worship me alone. I made this part of my last khutbah before I came. Because I told the people that, you keep doing this, and then you're going to be punished. If you keep on stressing that this is a civilian rulership, not a religious state, and then Allah will look at you and, look at a people that are distancing themselves away from Him. So why should He support you? You look at, this chauvinism, and chauvinistic patriotism, and then you destroy your uprise. Because مَا كَانَ لِلَّهِ دَمَا اتَّصَرْ Whatever it is that's for Allah will continue and prosper. So it's not for Allah, it's not. And so that was also one of the negative developments. That is not to say that all the people were like this, but that is to say that the government was able to appeal to those emotions, lower instincts of people, xenophobia, etc. And the media of the government is just amazing. They are in a different world completely. For instance, 700,000 people could be out in the square, and then they say 8,000, completely out of touch. Besides lying, it's a machine that produces all kinds of rumors and all kinds of, that tries to sort of seed convictions into the minds of people. Ugly. It is so-called intellectual prostitution. It is just truly, it is. So that treaty is annoying, disgusting. Huh?
Yeah,
there is a lot of misinformation, and that brings us to an important issue, which is what I started with when I talked about education. Because demagogy is really preys on the lack of education of the people. It exploits people's unawareness, people's feeble-mindedness, people's lack of knowledge, lack of critical thinking, lack of awareness. So it's an appeal to each and every one of us to improve our education, to be readers. Iqra is Islamic, is an Islamic principle. Iqra, read. And read and try to comprehend too, so it would be helpful. It is dangerous. It's amazing how you see the mobs can be moved by those campaigns of misinformation. And the idea here is that evidence is not the issue, because you could quote 200 ayats from the Quran, but misconstrue them. So the fact that you have authentic evidence is not all, you're not done. Your argument is not correct because you're quoting authentic evidence. But the appropriateness of the evidence, the pertinence of the evidence to the matter at hand is quite important. And people who have feeble education, they're not going to be able to see the appropriateness or lack thereof of the evidence to the matter that is being discussed. So yes, like we can get you anything in the Quran. You know, it's Qur'an Misra inshallah, I mean, for instance. You know, enter Egypt, God permitting, with security. What does this have to do with, you know, quitting the protest? Why is it patriotic to keep someone who has, why is it patriotic to keep a tyrant, this despotic regime, in power for 30 years, and to continue to keep it is your manifestation of your love for your country? Why should it not be the opposite that is patriotic? So here is the important struggle for us, is to really build the individual that will not be subject to deception, the individual that will be a thinker, that will not be swayed back and forth by misinformation and orchestrated campaigns of misguidance. And that is our duty, to build this individual within ourselves and to help, you know, build those individuals within our communities and in our countries, because ultimately that will make it or break it. At the end of the day, that will make it or break it. You can't imagine, you know, had it not been for the immense stupidity of the government, they would have been able to win very easily, because the people could actually be influenced very easily by any emotional appeal. You know, when Hosni Mubarak gave his second speech and talked about, you know, I'm Egyptian, I was born here, I'll die here, be buried here, it was hard to tweet, and so women, you know, and it's just like, you know, now this is a president, and this is not your uncle. This is a different type of relationship. So, and then they start to talk to the people about, you know, if your father is, someone tells you, you know, kick out your father from your home, even if you dislike your father, that's the prime minister, such a luminary, who's quite narcissistic. You know, that prime minister is just a narcissist. So he's like, you know, if someone tells you, kick your father out of the home, someone foreign, you know, not from the family, tells you kick the father out of the home, would you do it? Certainly not. Even if you dislike your father. So now first of all, what is the relationship between the president and the father? They're trying to make it like Sadat, the former president, he is the head of the household. Like we're all one family, he's the head of the household. Well, it's a different relationship. You know, you don't get things mixed up. The relationship between the president and the people is different from the relationship between the father and the family. Besides, whoever said that the foreigners wanted me to kick my father out, the foreigners are the ones who established this father in this home, supported him, gave him money, billions, $30 billion, from just the U.S. In support. They backed him politically throughout the years. They considered him to be the safety valve for the Middle East or this and that. So now, not only did this father terrible is not applicable, but also you're trying to convince me of the quite the opposite of the reality. Now, the people, if they don't have the power of analyzing information given to them, they get sentimental. And they say, certainly, your father, you don't kick your father out of you and stuff. And then, you know, look at, he's an old man, he's 82 years old. So that is not a pretext now for him to relieve himself and to have a little rest. It becomes a pretext for us to keep him because he's an old man. You know, should be 82 years old, should be respectful. Well, irrespectful is one thing, but living a tyrant, you know, the right of the Sunnah, the Sahaba, did not respect his old age because he was 100 years old in Hunayn. But he was a plotter against the Muslims. He was an enormous strategic aid to the enemies. At any rate, it is extremely important that we do not get extra cheerful to the point of intoxication. This was a great development. The riddance of Egypt from a tyrant ruler is a great relief, is a great source of happiness. But it's a step on the way, and many steps to follow. And many of those steps will be larger, bigger, more momentous, and require more work to really build the individual that will prevent the recurrence of tyranny. Prevent the recurrence of tyranny. That's the most important thing, is not to get rid of tyranny, but it's to have the power, the capacity, the ability to prevent its recurrence. This is one of the most important things.